WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. All of our WNST programming brought to you by our friends at Raskin Global, making the American dream come true. Leonard joins me every week, as well as our friends at Blondell Miller Schuler. Todd came on in the aftermath of the purple afterglow of a huge Sunday night victory over the Kansas City Chiefs. We've never won an AFC Championship game here at home, but it sure sounded like that in the aftermath. And we're going out to Detroit. And I love getting the sage sports writers, the colleagues of John Stedman. Lynn Henning from Detroit will be glad to know that, I don't know, about 50 or 60 most broken down sports writers, as Steady would say, gathered over at the Guinness Open Gate Brewery on Saturday, about 100 degrees out. Molly Dunham and Stan Rappaport put it together. The News American, the Baltimore Sun, and Evening Sun, all of the sports writers got together. If we only had our own Lindell AC here in Baltimore, wow. Lynn Henning.
Yeah, that was the real deal. That represented an era that we're fortunate to have at least known, at least some of us, Nestor. But Baltimore is never too far from a good saloon where media people can convene. I know that from experience.
We were discussing the old Burke's Goblets of Michelob back in the day. Lynn, how many years for you? When did you start at the News?
I started my sports writing career technically in 1974, the year I got out of Michigan State. And I went to the Detroit News in 79 after a couple of stops in Lansing, in Battle Creek at papers in Michigan. Then I went to the News, 79. So by the time I formally retired in 2019, it had been 40 years and really more like 45 years professionally, but I'm still working, gosh, it doesn't feel like I'm disconnected because I'm still working a couple of times a week for them.
Well, let's connect to the Lions just briefly. For a short period of time, my good friend James Schwartz ran the program around there. Then Caldwell, who I knew obviously from the Ravens winning the Super Bowl, came in. Except that I've lost track of all of it. I certainly watched the game on Monday night, saw the quarterback. Of all of the programs there's ever been, even the Browns and the Bengals that are in our division, we talk about the Lions thing. I sort of kidded you about, like, let's talk some Plimpton, right? Because it's been going on that long with the Lions. And I think people in Baltimore don't even understand that sort of eternal struggle where it was Hockey Town and it was Kirk Gibson at one point and Alan Trammell and Lou Whitaker. But the poor Lions, you know, all of these years, and you've chronicled this from the beginning, and it doesn't look like it's going to get any better this week, Sunday at one.
No, it one trivia question you can play that really is kind of fun in a dark way is ask any particular gathering of people, how many playoff games do you think the Lions have won since 1957? And you usually get three or four. They've won one. They've won one playoff game since 1957.
That just sort of stops and drops the mic. Like, when you have to take a moment to process that.
You do.
When you consider, I've talked 2 weeks ago about Ghost to the Post in 77, right, with my dad, going to that game, going to the Steelers playoff game when the plane went in the upper. Like, that's my childhood. And then you take it back to 57 and there's been one. We didn't have a franchise for 13 years here.
And the common denominator for the last 60 years almost has been the Ford ownership. William Clay Ford, the owner until he died a few years ago, always thought it was about a coach. He never understood the first commandment of any professional franchise. You better have a GM who knows how to put together a roster. He always thought it was a coach or a quarterback or an offense or something like that. He never got the idea that it's roster assembly. And that was really at the core of it. Well, then they finally got wise to it over the last 20 years, but they made a couple of mistakes with Matt Millen and then a subsequent regime, Martin Mayhew and company, which wasn't terrible, but just not the kind of group that could really deliver a playoff team with any regularity. And so they went and tried another round here with a guy from the Patriots who just didn't wash out. And it really has been mind-boggling until now. I think they have it right, Nestor. And of course, I've said that a couple of times before, but they finally, I think, with Brad Holmes, and he's got a great assistant too, and they've got the right coach in Dan Campbell. Not that, again, coaching has been really what this is all about. But John Dorsey and Brad Holmes, I think, in the GM's office really have the bases covered. And by about next year, after next year's draft, I think you're going to be able to see here something rather gainful. Now, Matt Stafford, the trade was part of that team turning, in fact, northward because the draft picks that they're going to assume next year, but also because they finally also did the merciful thing and got Matt Stafford to a team that surrounds a great arm and quarterback. And that's why I think the Rams could go to the Super Bowl.
Hey, I was going to say they're trying to free Britney Spears in court, right? I mean, freeing Matt Stafford was sort of right up there, and watching him. A little primer on Stafford and what happened there. I mean, look, we got rid of Flacco here at the end, and it looked like the end that he won the thing, right? Stafford comes in right around the same time, a little after. But thoughts about what that legacy looks like that you had that kind of quarterback, and they never could sort of capture the butterfly.
No, and I knew when I saw Stafford at University of Georgia, and I covered a couple of games, you get an arm like that about once every 10 years. And sure enough, he displayed all that with the Lions, and he was durable. He was just tremendous. But they didn't put enough of a team around him. And so he was sabotaged. And the humane thing to do is get him to an NFL team that can exploit his skills. And that's what the Rams are now doing. You know, Sean McVay knew what he was getting, and they're going to absolutely be, I think, enormously gratified in the difference that a quarterback on his level can make with a team. They're already seeing it a couple of weeks into the season. They're going to see it throughout this fall.
And we see the Rams in week 17. Week 3, we take on the Detroit Lions going out to Motown. Lynn Henning is here. You can follow him at Lynn_Henning. And I love this. This sort of a little bit like my Twitter feed. Sports, done that a long time professionally. We've gone through that. Politics, religion, history, movies, TV, restaurants, wine, outdoors. That, for me, Lynn, that's a lot more interesting than the Lions. So I want to take on the Gilbert Detroit situation in your town. I'm in Baltimore. I did sports forever. Brian Billick was my partner on behalf of Living Classrooms for 15 years now. I changed my brand in the last 3 years, taking my WNST radio brand, calling it Baltimore Positive. And, you know, I had our Republican governor on 2 weeks ago to have a crab cake. I had our Democratic Baltimore County executive on Acostas last Friday. I have the Democratic mayor of Baltimore, Brandon Scott, on at Coco's 2 weeks from now, all presented by the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play. The reclamation of a city is about so much more than any one thing. But you mentioned the word Ford makes a great vehicle. Thank you, Dennis Colazzos and Coons Ford, for sponsoring us. But certainly you witnessed your town, I guess, like a Springsteen song, right? My city of ruins, right? And then this attempt to resurrect it politically, spiritually, guys going to prison, corrupt mayors. You've had a lot of the similar thing we have, but much more size with Detroit, and probably the same situation you have in a state house where these idiots come in with machine guns into the state house looking for the governor. I went to the Eastern Shore and I'm seeing Confederate flags, and you make left turns, in Maryland. Lynn, bring me up to speed on Detroit and how it's doing, because certain people see places, and I look at Medellin and say, Baltimore can be better. We can lift ourselves. And Detroit's been in the process of doing that for 2 decades, right?
Right, and it's very analogous to Baltimore, because I remember Baltimore in the 70s and how woeful things had turned. But then they had the two things that are essential to a rebirth. They have water, and you had infrastructure. And that's exactly what Detroit's got. It's part of that whole Great Lakes River and water and Great Lakes system that, of course, speaks for itself. And if anybody's been there and has seen the Great Lakes, they know the splendor that it surrounds three quarters of the state. Well, the Detroit River, which is really a strait that connects the Lake Huron, Lake St. Clair waterways to Lake Erie, is right there and was vital to the voyageurs and to the discovery, frankly, of North America. That's why the city was founded. It was founded in the same manner that great cities were founded throughout America. It industrialized early and was the home to job after job after job, particularly for blacks fleeing Southern racism. And then what happened? They lost hundreds of thousands of jobs from 65 until 1980. And what happened then? Oh, you're not going to live in our suburbs. You're not going to take our jobs out in the suburbs. Race led to poverty. There was an all-white police force, and guess what? Everything just combusted in 1967 when you had the worst, at that point, riots in American urban history. Well, it was going to rebound. It's taken decades, but downtown Detroit, Nestor, before the COVID, was absolutely the hottest story in urban renewal in America. Beautiful. All the kids were coming back down there to live again. They were all working down there. You had Quicken Loans. You had all these high-tech industries that had moved their Microsoft inventory down there and so forth. All the jobs were coming there. They were building the first new apartments in 50 years. This town was hopping. There's a reason that Comerica Park was drawing 3 million fans in the heart of downtown just in the last decade. People love going there. They love being in the park and go to bars and go to restaurants. They love a downtown mecca like that.
Greektown, baby. Let's go.
Well, Greektown used to be the only thing I had going for it. Well, expand Greektown by about 10 other sections, and you got downtown Detroit's restoration. COVID knocked it in the head, but only in the same way that it did everybody's. We're all coming back now to what had been earlier ways of life. And in this case, Detroit's restoration is huge down there. So many of the players want to live down there or live just 10 minutes. It's really a good, good, good urban story. But until you see it, you know, everybody's got this idea that you don't want to get out of your car. That's nonsense. That was always nonsense. I worked downtown. You could walk anywhere downtown. Poverty in the impoverished districts is where you're going to have crime, like you got in West Baltimore. You're going to have any place where you have poverty, you're going to have crime. But you're not going to have it in downtown Detroit. You're not going to have any problems walking down in the heart of the city. You weren't 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you weren't going to have any problems. But it was always misunderstood. Oh, don't go to Detroit. But the more people separate themselves from reality, the more the imagination takes over, dangerous, dark fantasy takes over, and you end up with problems.
Well, Lynn, I mean, we have the issue here of having The Wire, right? And now the Ravens have adopted the murder whistle from The Wire as part of, like, you're going to come into our stadium on the other night. I don't know whether you embrace that or don't embrace that. For better or worse, it's the city's brand. And as long as we have 300 murders a year and Fox News and, you know, that every morning there's a fresh murder to wake up to and a light to shine on that, I have plenty of people that say they won't come to Baltimore. Baltimore looked probably pretty alive to you on Sunday night, right, when Lamar Jackson's juking left and juking right and we're stripping balls and going forward on fourth and one. And sports and – I was born the week that the Tigers won the World Series. I was born October 14th, 1968. Okay. So that's when I was born, a year after the riots, obviously, but a tumultuous time, summer 68. And seeing how sports, whether it was the Olympics back then or whether it's the knee, and I had Dave Zirin on last week with his book on Colin Kaepernick, sports is an incredible civic builder, right? Like that it does bring people together and makes people think differently about things.
Oh, the people that were telling you all those nasty things about Baltimore were certainly not seeing the Baltimore I was seeing. I was down there every summer and I loved it. And I love it because I love cities and because I don't fear cities, nor should I fear cities. But those who want to wall themselves off in suburbia or in rural areas and imagine that this is just a place of hideous black people killing everyone. Unfortunately, that's a reality, and Fox News is going to feed that illusion every single hour of its programming. And that's the biggest problem today, why we have the divide we have nationally and in an urban and in suburban and rural division that seems to be, again, where they want to draw their lines of demarcation. Fox is absolutely energizing that, but they don't energize reality. They don't energize truth. They don't energize the experience that Baltimore or Detroit is. And I know, I've lived there. I've lived in the one area, and I visited the other one every single summer. I love Baltimore. I love Detroit. I'm a farm kid from the center of the state of Michigan. And I've seen it all, from the sticks to the essence of urban America. It's a wonderful country, but race will enable you to do one thing, fear and hate. And that is at the core of our division in this society today.
Lynn Henning giving me truth. That's why we bring him on. We call it Baltimore Positive. Another wise conversation all brought to you by our friends at Wise Markets. I had the $6 signature crab cake. Lynn, I've been, you know, I see the restaurants and wine. That's sort of at the end, but that's sort of at the beginning because we do that every day. We eat. I did 30 crab cakes in 30 days back in August, and it was a little bit of a, I turned 53 this year. You know, I'm here because of baseball. Luis Aparicio brought my father over in the 60s when he came from Chicago and was fighting with the ownership there, Mr. Vec. And it came over, and the beer brewer here in Baltimore, all he wanted to do was win. He didn't see race with Frank Robinson or culture with Luis Aparicio. And some influential people were involved in immigration and bringing my kind off the boat from Maracaibo to live a life over here. And 53 years later, I've sort of discovered all of this and having deeper conversations about all of this. But I've been all over the world, right? I've been all Europe, Australia. I've been through Asia chasing U2, and Cal Ripken and I walked the Great Wall of China back in 07 and, you know, outside of Beijing and Motenyu. I had never been to Deep Creek Lake. I had never been to Rocky Gap. I had never been to Crisfield, Maryland. I had never been to Smith Island. I had never really been off of 50 going to Ocean City or off of 70 going up to Breezewood to go to Pittsburgh to watch the Steelers play, right? So this summer, I took time to like get off the road, see Antietam, spend a little time in Frederick, Hagerstown, Cumberland, Oakland, Deep Creek Lake. I went fly fishing with Dan Rodericks, who is the Mitch Albom of Baltimore, if there's such a thing, right? So I did all of these, you know, sort of wild things, but the crab cake and Maryland, for a guy like you, I'm thinking the first thing you do when you get off a plane from Detroit is go to Fadley's and kill yourself a couple of crab cakes, right? I mean, we take it for granted here. But like, dude, from the middle of Michigan on a farm, when you come here, you're looking for a crab cake.
Well, yeah, that and great Italian food over in Little Italy. And I love mussels. I've taken the boat out there along the harbor and getting good mussels out there. I mean, I do it all, but I do that in any city that I'm in.
Same as me, man. You got to explore, man.
And you have to be open to all of the places that aren't necessarily famous. That's where you really find mines of gold are at places that are a little less celebrated, but are equally authentic and terrific.
All right. Well, you know, next time I come to Detroit, I got to figure this out with you. Or if we ever get in here for a baseball game, I mean, I know things have changed a little bit, you know, through the years in Detroit, but here, oh my, I mean, we can take it right back to sports and what this facility behind me did for our community when you were coming in here chasing Kirk Gibson and Alan Trammell and Lou Whitaker. And by the way, can I just, I want to have a drink to Sparky Anderson. Sparky was my favorite in the early 90s when I first had my press pass. To sit in there and watch Sparky Anderson chew barbecue and eat a crab cake off a paper plate with his socks off, spitting and barking and talking baseball, was the greatest thing in the world of my childhood, you know. But baseball and Camden Yards, when that thing happened from the 80s to the 90s, when you came here, and I'm sure you went to the aquarium, went to the Science Center, did the zoo, did all the Baltimore stuff, went, stayed across Keys, I'm sure, Lynn, at least Billy Martin wasn't there beating anybody up at night you were there. But for Baltimore, that change is something you saw on the outside and the inside, right?
Yeah. And of course, that's one of the reasons I've always had a soft spot for Baltimore. Earl Weaver's, I love those teams. Camden Yards, my favorite ballpark in America, and I cry every time I see it because Detroit,
Tiger Stadium was my favorite ballpark, and I cry every time I drive by it. Now, why is that?
And so what did they do? They built the absolute opposite of Tiger Stadium, or the absolute opposite of Camden Yards, and it's been the greatest tragedy of my professional sports following life in Detroit.
They built the wrong stadium?
Oh, they build it not only the wrong stadium, they build it upside down. And you never hear anybody talk about Comerica Park as a real destination spot. It's a gigantic monstrosity of a ballpark they've made some necessary adjustments that I said, even while they were building it, they were going to have to make. So make them now, but they didn't do it. I've been on that ballpark's case since it was in construction, and it was obtuse in its strategy. They were going to try to draw free agent pitchers by making this monstrously big ballpark. Well, that at first blush is nonsense when you think any pitcher is going to sign with me because I've got a big ballpark that's going to reduce his inefficiencies and errors and inadequacies is no pitcher I want on my roster to begin with. So even in that context, it was insane, but they completely went against the grain. But every time I go to Camden Yards, this is how you could have done it. This is what you should have done. This was sitting here as a model, as an example. This in Jacobs Field, as it came to be known in Cleveland, same thing. And what'd they do? They completely desecrated the legacy of Tiger Stadium and what Camden Yards in Cleveland had shown they could and should do.
Lynn, I know I told you this, man, on the 30-30 tour. I did 30 ballparks in 30 days. There was a great guy named Eric out in Detroit who did that, Eric Mueller, who I spent some time with before I did it, just to, you know, you're going to walk on the moon, you find a guy that's walked on the moon, right? 30 ballparks in 30 days was ambitious. But the day I was in Detroit was a Sunday, and I was going to Toronto, driving over. My wife was flying back to Baltimore for the week and then meeting me later in the week. And I had forgotten my passport, so big shout out to Ron Colangelo and the folks at the Tigers for helping me cross the border. But we left the ballpark in like the seventh inning, and the Tigers came back and won some miraculous game that day. But I wanted to go over to the site of Tiger Stadium, and I went over there on a Sunday, and they were playing ball. Yeah. And they invited my wife and I to get out of the car at the old Tiger. I mean, like, I don't need to drive to this cornfield in the middle of Iowa to have a Field of Dreams. Yeah. To me, right? Like, my wife and I played baseball. I stood in the same batter's box my cousin stood in 1956 to take hacks. You know what I'm saying? And this, so for me, Tiger Stadium was it. And we played a little ball. We have video of it. They're wearing old time uniforms. They even gave us a hot dog and offered us beer. But you know, those kinds of memories in the childhood, I couldn't drive past Memorial Stadium for a good 10, 15 years, you know, after it was leveled. Now I have John Hoey on from the Y. It's YMCA. It's awesome. Cal Ripken, Brooks Robinson, they've all participated in things there. And I drive by now, think of my dad without crying or, you know, curling up in the corner about it. But it bothered me. Do you get bothered driving by Tiger Stadium?
Well, they've got a beautiful new facility there. Detroit.
Do they? They did something.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Oh, my God. I got to come back.
Oh yeah, you'll say they did it proud. It's where youth play baseball, and they have all kinds of sporting events.
It was in the middle of sort of there was a sign up, contribute. This was all like a movement to do something nice there, and we did a very nice thing with, you know, what we've done on 33rd Street here. If you were to visit it, you'd say you might cry a little or think a little or think of Sparky or whatever you would think of Earl Weaver, but you'd say this was well-intentioned use of the space, as opposed to me looking for Crossley Field in Cincinnati and I couldn't find in a warehouse somewhere, right? I couldn't find home plate, Lynn.
Well, that's exactly why preservation is our best friend in these instances. And in Memorial, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I loved Memorial. Camden, again, will always be number one for me in this realm of ballparks.
You're a modernist, Lynn Henning. Who knew?
Old baby. But, you know, I did like Memorial. Of course, the Orioles have always, to me, represented baseball. And I'm sorry for the tough times, but they're getting better, too. And now with the farm system they're putting together, this is going to be a good baseball story in Baltimore finally here. I know you've waited long enough.
Yeah, I love your optimism. I've been here too long, you know, and I'm very concerned about the business and people coming back. And to your point, the reputation, Camden Yards, I was here when 3.6 million people came. You were here the first, second, third, fourth, fifth year when the change happened in the 90s. And that's what got me here. That's what moved me downtown. That's what's allowed me to live the last 18 and a half years of my life downtown and loving it as well. And I, you know, I'm looking forward to getting back to Detroit. Lynn Henning is here. He's Lynn underscore Henning. You can follow him. A 50-year journey of Detroit sports, news, politics, all sorts of things. He's out on Twitter as well. You're semi-retired. I say this to Bob Ryan. Bob comes on a couple times. Yeah. And I'm like, you're never retiring. Neither one of you.
No, and I like the fact that they want me involved, but it's this thing called institutional knowledge, which does come with the white hair. there are things that you've known for 50 years or even 60, and that is most helpful on top of all the context. So, and I think you get better at this job as you get older. So anyway, I'm blessed.
Get better at this job. I'm going to use that as part of my. So I'm going to use the snow on the mountain and the fire in the belly, and I'll, you know, get all that going. I love reading your work. I love following your work. Keep being mouthy. Keep being outspoken, and keep covering Detroit sports. Eventually, the Lions will. I mean, look, you just came on and you were positive about the Orioles. Like for me, I'd love to offer you some words of wisdom for the Lions, but I don't know that either one of these franchises, to your point, has the kind of ownership. I could go on a rant about Angelos. Took my press pass 15 years ago after 20, you know, like I could do all of that. But until that changes, you know, until the kid with the boots living down in Nashville who has no interest in running the team, until somebody's running it, it's, or in your case with the Lions, somebody's running, the wrong people running it.
Well, I really think that Lions and Orioles are almost in somewhat at the same point here of taking off, Nestor. I really do. And I can share your concerns about Angelos. Who wouldn't with the record here over the last couple of decades? But I think that's changing. And again, not only because they've been playing better ball of late, but because the farm system is really, really, really starting to flourish. And that's the key. Once you get talent coming up from the greenery of the minor leagues, you're going to have something more verdant on the big league level. And that's what the Orioles are headed toward inexorably here in my mind.
As I watch Manny Machado, you know, try to make the playoffs in the National League. I mean, Lynn, I still love baseball and want to be a part of it. And it's amazing how precipitously it's dropped. I mean, I had Dan Shaughnessy and Bob Ryan on, and they say there are days where the Red Sox are number four in Boston as a friend. Mm-hmm. That's kind of an amazing thing. And I know the Lions have always sort of weirdly been number one in Detroit, right? And you get your clicks and all of that, and Hockey Town and Bad Boys and the Pistons and all that stuff. But the Orioles ruled this place for a long time. I remember Kevin Byrne brought the Ravens in here in 96. He thought, oh my God, how will we ever get above the fall? Will Cal Ripken's here and the legend of Brooks Robinson? And oh, how the times they change, huh?
The NFL has that advantage, one game a week. But just wait till the Orioles put a product on the field. You're going to have your 3 million crowds back. This is what happened in Detroit 20 years ago. Everyone was worried about the Tigers having lost a generation of fans. 5 years later, they hit 3 million for the first time. They did 3 million four times in about 6 years. Once the product's on the field, the baseball team in baseball cities will have them hanging from the rafters. It'll be the same thing at Camden.
It's got to look as good on the field as it does on Tom Selleck's head, the Tiger hat, right? Yeah. Lynn, I appreciate you. It's always great to visit with you. Thank you for the wisdom. I appreciate it.
Okay, Nestor. Enjoy talking.
Lynn Henning. You can follow him at Lynn underscore Henning. Detroit news for only about 50 years. Sports, politics, religion, history, movies, TVs, restaurant, wine, outdoors. And always willing to take on a wise conversation. You can find us each and every Friday. We're doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour, moving it around. We're going to be at Greenmount Station in Hampstead this week. It's all presented by the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play, and we appreciate their sponsorship and support as well. As we get back to the city on the 8th of October, we'll be with Mayor Brandon Scott at Coco's. So a crab cake every Friday. It's working out so far. The last Friday's crab cake at Costas, and I had a Sunday crab cake at Wise, and the next thing you know, I'm having a victory crab cake at Fadley's on Monday. So there, I'm all crab caked up. I am ready for Detroit this week. I am Nestor. We are WNSD, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking. Baltimore, positive.